Michael Gord works in real estate, and the market is hot.
So we buy land, build experiences, and the intention is to rent out our land to big businesses who want to be participating in the metaverse.
Normally, we'd tell you where Michael lives and what real estate market he sells in, but that's irrelevant in this case, because his market is both nowhere and everywhere. It's the metaverse, hailed as the next iteration of the internet.
Right now, all internet infrastructure is flat. It's all two-dimensional. So whether you're using a phone, a tablet, a TV, a laptop, it's all flat infrastructure. The metaverse is the three-dimensional internet. So you can put a stage somewhere or a university somewhere, an office building somewhere. And really similar to the internet, anything you think you can put into new three-dimensional worlds.
A three-dimensional digital frontier where humans socialize, play games, shop, eat, open businesses, go to concerts, buy and sell stuff. Most of the digital land Michael's company has acquired is a facet of the metaverse called Decentraland, a completely digital city of sorts that feels about the size of Washington, D.C. An avatar walking down a virtual street in Decentraland will see many of the same things you might see in the brick-and-mortar world.
So you might see an art gallery, or you might see a building for commercial reasons. You might see a stage for concerts. You might see a university. You might see a forest. You might see a castle. You might see houses.
Again, none of these things are physical, but people are willing to pay very real money for them.
The lowest price on the public market right now is $20,000 approximately for a single parcel.
That's the starting price for a single parcel of digital land in Decentraland. This is but one aspect of the metaverse that stretches the mind, if not credulity. Because the distinguishing feature of anything digital, in my opinion at least, is its perfect, infinite replicability. Real-world real estate operates heavy on scarcity of supply versus demand, but in the digital world, things are, strictly speaking, infinite. You could build properties on virtual land that never ends. There is something about the blockchain in here, which we'll explore later, but how does a market value that? Well, Michael Gord shrugs aside annoying questions like that and says yes. Instead, look at Silicon Valley's favorite metric, growth.
Decentraland is becoming the biggest social network in the world, in my opinion. Just by the numbers, it went up from 15,000 users in January to 400,000 users in November. And I think it's going to be about 600,000 users in December, which is about a times 40 increase in users in this year. That has now reached the tipping point. But if we just continue at the same growth rate, then next year, if it grows another times 40, that'll be 20 million. Another times 40 the next year is 800 million. And then by in 3 years, which is only 2024, everyone on Earth will be using the metaverse.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The promise of everyone on Earth using the metaverse. Whether or not that's a future you want, tech titans of the world certainly do. Mark Zuckerberg renamed Facebook Corp Meta and described his vision for the metaverse as an, quote, embodied internet, where instead of just viewing content, you are in it. And today, the fourth installment of the visionary Matrix movie series is out. The Matrix Resurrections marketing tagline reads, quote, now based on real events. Is that the promise of the metaverse? A fluctuating border between reality and virtual. Are we already there? And what happens when we can't tell the difference? And by the way, that question is one that Wired magazine asks in a terrific series of articles, Wired Peers into the Future of Reality, and we will hear from a Wired writer in just a bit. But first of all, I want to start today with the woman who's called the godmother of the metaverse. Kathy Hackle joins us. She's Chief Metaverse Officer and CEO at Futures Intelligence, which is a leading consultancy working with brands on metaverse and Web 3.0 strategies. Kathy Hackle, welcome to On Point.
Excited to be here.
So you are the godmother of the metaverse. Why do you think you've gotten that title?
That title actually was given to me by a team member at Nike's Metaverse team. So, you know, Nike has gone all in on the Metaverse. The community started to use it. Metaverse and Web3 is very community driven. I wear the name proudly.
Okay. So the fact that we've already mentioned some really big brands gives us a hint as to a major part of what the Metaverse is or what it's envisioned as becoming. But for those of us who are complete newbies to this, I mean, how would you define what the Metaverse is, first of all, right now?
Yeah, I think it's important to start in the past and show people where we're heading. So Web 1.0, the beginning of the internet, connected information. We got the internet that changed a lot of things, of course. Then we moved into Web 2.0, which connected people. And that gave us the sharing economy, gave us e-commerce, and gave us social media, right? That changed a lot of things and, gave us some of the tech juggernauts of today. We're in the evolution of Web 2.0 going into what's called the Web 3.0. And Web 3.0 connects people, places, and things, or people, spaces, and assets. And sometimes these people, spaces, and assets might be in a fully virtual environment, something like Decentraland or even virtual reality. Or it will also be in our physical world with some level of augmentation. So augmented reality is also part of where we're heading. The metaverse is enabled by Web3. The metaverse is enabled by many different technologies like augmented reality, virtual reality, blockchain, AI, 5G, you name it, any jargon, any tech term you can add there. But the metaverse, in essence, is almost envisioning the digital lifestyle you've been living on your phone and your computer, kind of catching up to your physical lives. It's a convergence of physical and digital. It's the next, it's the successor to today's mobile internet. And it's kind of where we're heading. It's a true convergence.
How far along are we already on that convergence?
So I don't think the metaverse or that greater vision of the metaverse that many of us are working towards is here yet. What I see right now are glimpses of the metaverse. And so some glimpses are, some of these tech juggernauts proposing their visions of what they think the metaverse should be. But there's also other parts of the community that are working towards something more open and decentralized. So you almost have two competing views. I would say the next 10 years are an incredible moment. It's an incredible moment for building and creating the future of the internet.
Okay. So, again, just getting a lay of the land here. we mentioned Decentraland, which our guest Michael just a few minutes ago described what he's doing there in terms of buying and selling real estate. That's sort of one of these on the virtual side of things, one of these virtual worlds. What are some of the other big ones that people may have heard of?
Yeah, so some of the other, let's say, more open and decentralized platforms, for example, there's Somnium Space, there's Upland, there's The Sandbox, there's, some games like Star Atlas as well that are, selling virtual land as well. There's High Street, which is a metaverse commerce, metaverse commerce platform and virtual world. So yeah, it's evolving. You almost have to see it as like there's some meta worlds of sorts that are like a Roblox or a Fortnite, the most well-known ones. And then there's other meta world platforms that are more open and decentralized, like Decentraland and those sorts of things. But I think the important part here is for people to understand that when people hear the term the metaverse, right, it's almost like you're talking about capital M metaverse. Mm-hmm. For example, if you're in New York, for example, there's a tri-state area, right? It's a place with three different places. So when you hear the term the metaverse, you almost have to envision the greater metaverse, capital M. And within that greater capital M metaverse, there's these metaverses, lowercase m, or meta worlds or metaverse platforms that make up that are going to make up that greater vision of where we're heading in this high-speed train that I mentioned.
Okay, fascinating. So we're talking about the little m metaverse. Versus in your
yes.
in your analogy there, but the ones that I just asked you about are virtual worlds or games all built in virtual worlds. You also mentioned, well, actually, before we leave that entirely, I will fully admit I do not understand how real estate is. Well, I don't even want to call it real estate. Virtual estate is valued in a metaverse world. I mean, how do they come up with a $20,000 value for a plot of land in Decentraland?
Well, a lot of that is the secondary market, which is, you know, really interesting. This is, I think, what frames the value. Let's start with this. Yeah. In the Web 2.0 era that I mentioned, you could, you know, what could you own then, right? You could own a domain. That's pretty much all you could really own, right? In this Web 3.0 space, you're able to own virtual real estate or virtual land. You're able to own digital assets. So it's almost like changing the mindset and the chip of owning a future of the a part of the future of the internet. So it's digital ownership of digital assets. And I think that that is the big difference. So how are the prices set? I mean, that has to do a lot with how much you know, virtual real estate is available. So there is an element of fear of missing out. Mm. There is also like at mint, some land sales might be cheaper. So when you buy them right when they're available, they might be a little cheaper. And then the secondary market where you're able to sell these digital assets, prices tend to increase.
Right.
You know, some of these virtual worlds have land sales, right? Their drops are land sales. So those are, you know, a rush to get that piece of the future of the internet. So it's an evolution it's an evolution when it comes to ownership and thinking about what could you own in Web 2.0. You couldn't really own, you know, you didn't own your Twitter handle, you didn't own your Instagram handle, not really. But in this Web 3.0 future of the internet that we're heading into, there is that possibility and that, you know, that possibility of owning, of digital ownership of digital assets.
So we've got about 30 seconds before the first break. The evolution of the concept of ownership is absolutely fascinating here. But Kathy, I don't want you to think I'm like a complete troglodyte here. I just don't understand how value can be set for something that, like, these companies can, they could drop more land parcels ad infinitum, right? I mean, if there's an infinite supply, technically, how is there any actual value around these things?
Well, I think just like with real estate, it's about location, and who, you know, who's buying land in those worlds, like Snoop Dogg.
Snoop Dogg. Okay, so Snoop Dogg does not have FOMO because he's already a first to market in the metaverse. Well, we are talking about what is the metaverse? How might it change our lives, both virtually and in reality? And we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the metaverse, what it is, what the vision of it might be, and how it may have an impact on your life, whether virtual or real. And kind of getting even deeper into this question of what happens when we can't tell the difference between the two. And also, it just so happens that today the fourth Matrix movie is out, The Matrix Resurrections. And as I mentioned earlier, the marketing tagline for the film says, now based on real events. So maybe we're in a world where it doesn't matter what pill you choose to take. But I'm joined today by Kathy Hackle. She's Chief Metaverse Officer and CEO at Futures Intelligence Group. And Kathy, hang on here for just a second, because we reached out to Neil Stephenson, best-selling author, and his latest book is Termination Shock. But as you know, and many listeners know as well, back in 1992, Neil published Snow Crash, a novel set in a dystopian near-future world where humans could interact as avatars within a vast virtual universe. Again, this is back in 1992, and he called it the metaverse.
In the story, it's what we would today call a massively multiplayer online environment, just meaning it's an imaginary space where you can go and interact in real time with lots and lots of other people, regardless of where you're physically located on the planet. And it's mostly accessed through virtual reality or augmented reality hardware. So you're seeing things in 3D, you're hearing them in kind of a spatialized audio, And it's all kind of working in real time so that when you see something happen from your point of view in the metaverse, the other people around you see the same thing from their point of view.
So the metaverse Stevenson conceived has some things in common with what we think about or what Kathy Hackle described as what the metaverse might be today and in the future. But there are some key differences.
Right now, when people say metaverse in their marketing literature, what they're sort of getting at is that we want to sell you something that you don't already own. You already own probably a TV set and computers and tablets that can show you pretty good graphics on a two-dimensional rectangle. Now we want to sell you the next generation of consumer hardware and the software and the services that will make that hardware worth buying, if you will.
In other words, big business has come for the metaverse. Of course, Facebook is perhaps the most obvious one with their big rebrand to Meta this past October. Here's CEO Mark Zuckerberg in the video announcement after sharing that Facebook, as I just mentioned, would be known as Meta.
Hey, and welcome to Connect. Today, we're going to talk about the metaverse, starting with the most important experience of all, connecting with people. Imagine you put on your glasses or headset and you're instantly in your home space. It has parts of your physical home recreated virtually, it has things that are only possible virtually, and it has an incredibly inspiring view of whatever you find most beautiful.
CEO Mark Zuckerberg there of Meta, a.k.a. Facebook. Well, joining us now is Cecilia D'Anastasio. She's a staff writer covering games in the gaming industry at Wired. And as I mentioned, Wired has a terrific series out called Wired Peers into the Future of Reality. And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Cecilia, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. And also, just great job that Wired did on their series. I read every single one of the articles and they're awesome. So who is the metaverse really for, Cecilia?
That's a really good question. I think if you asked a lot of big tech companies, they would say the metaverse is for everybody. But some of the hardware that you need to access it is not for everybody. For example, to access Meta's, formerly Facebook's, Horizon Worlds, quote-unquote metaverse, you might need to spend $300 to get an Oculus headset from that same company.
So it's for business to sell us more stuff, as Neil Stevenson was saying?
I might agree with that premise, yeah.
So you sound I can't tell if you're vigorously dubious about the purpose of the metaverse or just cautious here.
Well, nobody is more bullish than me about the potential for virtual worlds to, you know, unlock so much joy and human connection. I have been playing online video games, gosh, since I was a child, and the friendships I've made there, the ways that I've self-actualized in those worlds, I mean, it's incredible. It's amazing. And it's interesting to see the way that has been kind of rebranded as a metaverse by big tech companies in the recent months.
Okay. Kathy Hackle, do you want to respond to that? That I guess what Cecilia is saying is that, and it's true, there were already worlds out there, digital worlds. We talked about them in the earlier segment, that people were happily playing in and socializing in and didn't necessarily need the Facebooks or the Nikes of the world to rebrand it as the metaverse and turn it more into what seems like an exercise in digital capitalism more than anything else.
Yeah, what I see happening here, and Cecilia, I agree with you and most of what you say. I feel like it's almost like you've got two different competing visions, right? One is that big tech walled garden, you know, metaverse vision that is being presented by a lot of the tech giants. And another one is the one that has been kind of happening in the Web3 community, which is more open and decentralized, community-driven, creator-driven. So, you know, obviously the big tech juggernauts of the world have a bigger megaphone. So you almost have these two competing visions. And you almost see it in kind of how some people are starting to view Silicon Valley not so much as the heart of the future of the internet. So definitely, Cecilia, I agree. And I loved your articles, by the way.
Thank you.
And so Kathy, you agree then, but where Where does that leave us? Because you'll have to forgive my cynicism here, but especially when it comes to the vast wealth, power, reach, and influence that these same companies have, I think I do come to the idea of what the metaverse might be with more than a grain of salt, because is it going to be shaped by the same companies that we're talking about?
I think some of them will shape it, but I think that you've got up-and-coming Web3 players that should not be disregarded, that have a completely different vision in mind. Like, for example, the Sandbox, some of the articles that I've read, like, they're not interested in talking to Meta right now. So, I think it'll be, it'll give rise to new opportunities and new companies. What I envision, and Cecilia, you might envision something similar maybe, is we potentially will have some walled gardens, right? Like the Metas of the world that might talk about being open, but only within their family of apps. But there might be another component that is more open and decentralized, where you are able to go from one virtual world to another. So I do see an evolution. To me at this point, to be honest, Web2 in Silicon Valley is starting to feel a little old when it comes to where the future is heading.
Cecilia, what do you think?
I agree that Web2 does feel a little bit old. It's interesting, though, because if you think about the history of the internet over the past several decades, there's been a trend toward consolidation. This is how big tech got big. You had, Kathy, like you explained so eloquently before, Web 1.0, which was mostly about publishing your GeoCities website, kind of just putting yourself out there on the internet. Web 2.0, in contrast, was about these companies like Facebook, now Meta, giving you the opportunity to publish through them. They become these platforms, right? The reason why they were able to do that is because they ate up all of these smaller companies that provided similar services and grew their user bases to become big tech. So it's interesting to me that a lot of these big tech companies now are saying, hey, actually, we'd like to work with these other companies to make our metaverses interoperable, when in practice, you're seeing companies, just sort of Katamari-like becoming larger and larger and eating up their competition. Mm.
You know, Cecilia, I'm wondering what you also think of what Kathy said a little bit earlier about the metaverse, or the concept of what the metaverse might be, changing our definition of what ownership is. And you know what fascinates me so much about that is I'm old enough to remember when the promise of the internet was that it would be sort of this free, almost libertarian space, right? That wasn't constrained by ownership. That there would be this exchange of ideas and experiences that in almost a revolutionary way. But now it almost seems like the pendulum is swinging back in the other direction, and the old fashioned idea of "that is mine" is one of the defining features of the vision of this new metaverse.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Like, as somebody who plays a lot of video games, and I do spend some money on, like, outfits for my characters and video games and things like that, I think it'd be really awesome to own those outfits myself and not feel like I was renting them from a big video game company. I think it'd be doubly awesome to take that outfit from Final Fantasy XIV and wear it, in Fortnite. But this is one of the central tensions of the metaverse as big tech companies describe it. Interoperability, the ability for you to, move your avatar, move your items from one platform to another. And right now, I'm not seeing anything, at least from large platforms like Roblox, like Fortnite, like Final Fantasy XIV, that is giving me any optimism that I'll be able to sort of transfer my assets and really fully own them anytime soon.
Mm. Okay, you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to take a step back here, because Kathy, you and we've been focusing a lot on the virtual worlds here that might make up the little M metaverses. But Kathy, you had said something so important a little earlier, that the metaverse also is going to become part of our physical world. So, on the one hand, you could take off the VR goggles and maybe exit the virtual worlds. But if that same technology and ethos is going to be part of our physical world, I want to hear more about how. Because you've given some interviews in the past where you've said the metaverse is going to change the way we engage with information, with our physical world. It'll be a critical part of our children's and grandchildren's future lives. So what would a day in the life of the metaverse actually look like? Can you walk me through that?
Yeah, definitely. And I do want to preface this by saying I come to this from having worked at Magic Leap with Neil Stephenson, creating augmented reality glasses, for lack of a better term. So I did get a glimpse of what the potential future could look like. Okay. So when I think of that physical, you know, to me, to be honest, I love the virtual world side of the metaverse. But to me, the most important impact that it'll have on humanity in some ways, the most visual, let's say, will be in the physical world, right? Right now, we're doing a lot of things with our phones. We use it to take us places and to find restaurants. But eventually, we are going to be moving away from our mobile phones, because there's only so many more cameras we can add to an iPhone, right? And we're going to move into a wearable, and that's potentially some type of glasses. And this is a very hard problem to solve. So, you know, I envision someone, you know, probably 2030, you know, in the 2030s or beyond, wearing, you know, glasses that actually put a lot of data in front of them. So instead of looking at, you know, your phone when you're trying to drive somewhere, you're actually going to see, you know, lines that tell you where to go, that tell you where an accident is. You're going to be able to, you know, have a hologram call with grandma. You're going to be able to, you know, dress your avatar in different clothes and have, you know, people see your outfit in different ways. So one of the things that in a lot of us in the community talk about is, you know, being able to do things with fashion we've never been able to do before, because it might be virtual. So it might be in the physical world. You might see me through glasses. You might see my outfit, but my outfit might be on virtual fire, not on real fire, because that is very dangerous. But I might be able to do things that we weren't able to do before because we're consuming content in a different way. So, you know, these glasses, this, you know, future of wearables, you know, future of how we'll see data is going to change how we engage with the physical world. And I think that personally, that to me is going to be a huge moment when it comes to unlocking this greater vision of the metaverse. And it'll have a significant impact on how we shop, how we, you know, how we socialize, how we work. So envisioning that future that many of us have seen in sci-fi movies, but in a true way being worked on currently.
Mm. So you've written extensively about this sort of vision for a day in the life, and you have this fictional character, Katie Wu. But I just want to read a paragraph from it, because these concrete examples of what could be, I think, are most helpful for all of us listening who are still trying to understand what the metaverse could do, whether or not we're playing Roblox or own a parcel in Decentraland. So you say that with the augmented reality glasses, this fictional character of Katie gazes out the window, sipping her morning coffee. The neighboring buildings fade away, replaced by unicorns grazing in a field. The sounds of nature echo through the glasses' built-in spatial audio that realistically responds to her head movements. The unicorns help her brain train and assist her in starting off her day with a meditation that centers Katie and allows her to start off her day in a positive way. And then you also talked about how AR glasses can, you know, show, say, processes and flows that you need to accomplish at work. It can make your home look like your workplace, or maybe vice versa. Interesting about, I think, how do you call it? Like, I don't know, social projecting, like social information onto other people that the AR glasses see. Long story short, you're envisioning a future where we are dwelling physically in the physical reality, but our brains are comprehending essentially a virtual world of our own creation. Is that right?
Yeah, I see it as, you know, we're still physical beings in the physical world, right? So we are sometimes going to want to be fully in those virtual spaces and those virtual worlds, but sometimes we still want to be in the physical world. The physical world is beautiful, right? I still want to go to Iceland, right? For example, it's still gorgeous and beautiful. But what I do think is the glasses are just going to bring a level of information and data that we're used to consuming on our phones. It's going to put it in front of our eyes, right? And it's just going to change the way we engage with content and with data, you know, and to us, like maybe today in 2021, it might seem really strange, but if we were to have this interview in 5 years, maybe not 5 years, but 10, let's say 10 years, we would have been like, oh, it makes total sense. That's how we live today. Just like we never envisioned we would live a lot of our lives on our phones.
So Cecilia, again, I'm going to just play I'm getting my Greek, my stories mixed up. The one who says the sky is falling, that's going to be me. Because, I mean, look, we are already a truth-challenged society now. And what the downside The enormous downside I hear to this vision of the future is the complete destruction of any notion of a shared reality, Cecilia. I would not be surprised if that, too, is something that we have to face in 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's a really big question. I think that the description shared about, you know, this future is very science fiction. You know, back in the 80s, even before that in the 70s, people, you know, very intelligent technologists were saying, we will be adopting VR. This will be totally mainstream. And it's been decades since that conversation. And I'm just not seeing it happen in a mainstream way anytime soon.
Yeah. Except for the fact that, I mean, due to social media itself in the Web 2.0 world that we're all familiar with, we are seeing the breakdown of the concept of a shared reality. So we're going to talk more about that and how that might be potentially put on steroids in the world of the metaverse when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the metaverse, what it is, when it might be, and how it might shape all our lives, whether virtual or in reality. And we're getting a lot of feedback online here in the Web 2.0 world, I should say. Casey says, our actual reality is a global pandemic. Therefore, this is the perfect time to connect with others virtually. G. Stinson says, why do we need a metaverse? We can't seem to fix issues in reality. And JBK says, as if kids aren't already addicted enough to their phones and screens, having a tough enough time dealing with the real world. Let's put VR goggles on them so they can descend even further into make-believe. Another doubter here, Todd Selmar, says, another tech thing to disrupt reality. Reality is already disorienting. Thanks to the Zuck, I think I might be a conscientious objector on this one. I'm out. Well, I'm joined today by Cecilia D'Anastasio. She's a writer covering games and the gaming industry for Wired. And Wired has a terrific series out right now called Wired Peers into the Future of Reality. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Kathy Hackle is also with us. She's Chief Metaverse Officer and CEO at Futures Intelligence Group. They're a leading consultancy working with the world's brands on metaverse and Web 3.0 strategies. So, Kathy and Cecilia, just stick with me here for a little bit because, you know, if it hadn't been for the past, say, five-ish years and the impact of social media, maybe I wouldn't feel so urgently about these big sets of questions about the responsibilities we have as a society when it comes to how technology shapes our perception of reality. But I do feel profound urgency around that. So we reached out to Shoshana Zuboff, professor emeritus at Harvard Business School and author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. And she says that when it comes to this big virtual 3D and augmented reality metaverse, we cannot forget a simple truth about Facebook and other companies who want to be big players shaping the metaverse.
How is it that we have lived with Facebook and its atrocities for this long and somehow not perceived that it is a profit-maximizing corporation, as all corporations are? Your only job in society is to maximize profits for shareholders, period. And that's what Facebook does.
And how? by collecting data and using it to predict human behavior.
It collects raw material that can be analyzed and turned into predictions of human behavior at the individual and the collective level. And those predictions are sold, and its entire market capitalization is built on this proposition.
And in the metaverse, Facebook, Apple, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, other companies are poised to have a slew of new ways to capture the most minute details about us, our identities, the totality of our lives. Once again, here's Neal Stephenson, who originally conceived of the metaverse in his dystopian science fiction novel, Snow Crash.
The new platforms are going to have many, many more ways of extracting personal data from you and your family than the old ones do. When you're interacting through a keyboard or a touch screen, even with those, it's actually surprising how much information they can extract. But it's inherent in the way a virtual reality headset works that it's watching you all the time. It's got cameras tracking your eye movements. It can tell how fast your heart is beating. It can tell when your pupils dilate. It can back out information about your emotional state, your reactions from that. It's listening to your speech. So it's the most complete surveillance technology that's possible to have, short of actually shoving electrodes into your brain. And maybe that's next.
The idea that if you don't participate in the metaverse, you're not going to be impacted by it is foolish, silly an idea as saying, you know, if you don't participate in Facebook, you're not going to be impacted by it.
Shoshana Zuboff says the past 4 years have provided ample evidence of the humanity-wide impact of surveillance capitalism. She says the companies have already pulled off what she calls an epistemic coup, shaping not only what we know, but how we know it, our very perception of truth and reality that has metastasized into our economy, society, and politics. For Zuboff, the metaverse would be that epistemic control on steroids.
Mr. Zuckerberg has said himself, the metaverse is everything. The metaverse is everywhere. There are no boundaries to it. It's a kind of, they like the word persistent. The word persistent means it's always on. It's never off. It's always there. It's everywhere, and it encapsulates everything. In our world today, every app that you use, every app, there is no exception. It's collecting data from your phone, and then it's trudging along through the ether, and it's dumping off those saddlebags of data into Facebook servers and Google servers and other ad tech servers. And even if you have a phone and you keep it empty, that phone is tracking everything that you do. So what we're talking about is the difference between a society where there is such a thing as private human experience and a society in which all human data is essentially collected, analyzed, and owned as the corporate assets of private companies. There's an ideology here which is aimed at really separating citizens from their democratic governments so that the companies can become more powerful and there's no impediments to their rule and to their ability to do what they want, make money from it, and ultimately to have a bigger role and perhaps the dominant role in governing what we do.
Shoshana Zuboff, professor emeritus at Harvard Business School and author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. Kathy Hackle, a little earlier you talked about how people can buy, changing the models of ownership. That actually does seem quite exciting here. So you could buy a parcel of digital land. But do you have any right to the ownership of the vast amounts of data about yourself that you would be pouring into the metaverse, as both Neil and Shoshana there described?
So I think it's interesting that neither of them mentioned the word blockchain, right? I think that they're envisioning a very Web 2.0 version of the future, right? I'm personally working towards an open, decentralized metaverse, not a closed walled garden. That's what I want to see. It's an open, decentralized metaverse. And to me, blockchain is one of those enabling technologies that will allow us to, in some ways, gain ownership again of our personal data and decide who we share it with, when we share it, and gain control of our identity. So I think that there is almost a bit of a contradicting narrative in that sense, that everything we're talking about right now seems pretty dystopic, very framed in the vision of Web 2.0 and how these walled gardens that have shareholders, right, want to see maybe the world, the future of the internet. I think there's a huge Web 3 community that is working towards an open, decentralized metaverse where users, not users, I'm not even going to call them users, where the community, that where the people that are part of the community own their own data, which is on the blockchain, and they're able to decide who gets to use it, who gets to see it. To me, in Web 3.0, and I might be a little bit of an optimist, I feel that the age of extraction that we've gone through in Web 3.0 is not going to work in Web 3.0, at least not in the way that many of us are building towards it. So I do think, you know, there is maybe, I don't know, it's interesting to me that no one mentions the blockchain as one of the ways to help with figuring out how we, you know, how we gain access and control back of our personal data.
Okay, so I appreciate that. I actually do appreciate that little ray of optimism there. but seriously, just to follow along this path, if that would indeed happen, right, and people would regain control of their personal data through whatever technology, blockchain or others, then what's the draw for a company like Facebook or for any of the brands that you work with?
So I think that specifically, let's talk about Facebook or Meta, right? Yeah. They're an ad revenue. Their business is ad revenue, right? That's what they've been doing. And I think that one of the reasons that they rebranded and that they've put so much work into Facebook Reality Labs is because they see that the future is not in the Facebook app. That's not going to continue to grow. They know that they are going to have to change their practices. They're going to have to look at new revenue models and new ways of engaging with the community that, you know, that is not interested in being, you know, being served billboards in the metaverse. At least that's not the world I want. As a gamer, Cecilia, I'm sure you don't want that either. I do not want to see billboards in my games. I do not want to see billboards in the metaverse. That's not what I'm working towards. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the brands that I'm working with, we're thinking through open, potentially decentralized, if that's what they want to do, but being authentic, providing utility, and being community-driven, which I think is something that we lost in some ways in the Web 2.0 space. Mm.
Cecilia, do you think that the notion of personal privacy around data can comfortably coexist with the enormous business pressures that will even be further upon the metaverse or metaverses? Because look, right now, the best that my brain can manage is a Web 2.0 model. And we use all of these services that these companies ostensibly provide for free. But essentially, the cost of entry is the exchange of the service for your personal data and using it. Will companies really step back from what has been a spectacularly successful business model for them?
No, personal privacy and the sort of metaverse that big tech companies are describing are mutually exclusive. And I would describe, you know, the way that blockchain technology is, you know, purported to solve this problem is somewhat hand wavy. If you think about the kind of like AR augmented reality apps that we've even seen today, for example, think about Pokemon Go, right? Pokemon Go collects an enormous amount of location data from its users. I did an investigation on this at my previous publication, Kotaku. And we did a GDPR request for users' data while using this app. And it's just so the minutiae of where you go, which, you know, it's incredible. And location data is just such a lucrative business. And I don't see any way in which blockchain technology disrupts that or makes that any safer for a user who's worried about their privacy. There's just no world in my mind in which any sort of continuous exhaustive metaverse also respects users' privacy.
Kathy, do you want to respond?
Yeah, I think that, you know, at least the work that I'm seeing certain people do, like Outlier Ventures, in presenting that open decentralized metaverse is interesting. I know that, Cecilia, you interviewed Ryan Gill from Crucible as well. And there are people that have that vision and that, you know, I hope that that vision wins, right? The one that is open and decentralized that allows us to control our identity and our data using blockchain or other technologies. So, there is a bit of that, I think, a bit of opposing views of what the Web 2.0 space and how they want to see the metaverse evolve and how the Web 3 community and, you know, people working towards open decentralized are envisioning the future. Mm. How does that work itself out? I'm not sure. And which one will reign supreme? I hope it's the open decentralized one.
So, you know what? I fully acknowledge that innovation relies on idealism, right? Like, we have to imagine a different kind of future and then invent our way towards that. It's actually, you know, quite an inspiring synergy there. But at the same time, I can't turn away from what innovation that then turns to, you know, an enterprise built around maximizing shareholder profit has done already to our society. And you could say that in a world where social media is constructed to, you know, put you in a little silo, reflect back to you the kinds of things that will keep you on the sites, really overcharge your amygdala, things like that, we've seen terrible downsides to that. And what I wonder is, naively, we can at least think, well, you can log off of social media and at least take a break from that. But if we're talking about a future, which has been said multiple times today, where there will be no dividing line between when you're online and when you're not, that it will be a porous border, how can we feel any kind of confidence, Cecilia, that the same toxicities and society attacking behaviors won't just be 10 or 100 or 1,000 times worse in a metaverse world?
I don't have any confidence in that. Like Shoshana was saying, I mean, Facebook, now Meta, has proven to us over and over and over again that they have no ability to adequately govern their platform. In fact, even, you know, virtual worlds, online video games that have existed for decades still struggle with governing their platforms, you know, preventing people from being toxic, preventing abuse. This is an issue that nobody has solved and that there need to be very ample resources directed at in the future if we're going to even think about creating the sort of metaverse that big tech companies are describing.
Well, in that case, I'm glad that we're having these conversations now. And I'm especially grateful that the two of you could join us today in order to introduce us to what the metaverse is and deepen our understanding. So, Cecilia D'Anastasio, staff writer covering games and the gaming industry at Wired. And again, Wired has a terrific series about peering into the future of reality. We've got a link to that at our OnPoint website. Cecilia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Kathy Hackle, Chief Metaverse Officer and CEO at Futures Intelligence Group. It was truly a pleasure to have you on the show, Kathy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'll see you in the metaverse.
Maybe. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.